Cause you know Joel up in this.
Be keeping it real, you know we got international house of mojo. You best be listening to our show, yeah.
Hey everyone, this is Jason. I'm here with Remy and Roger, better known as Zarin.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
You know both of them from their scintillating news posts over the years on the front page.
Yeah, and this is the first podcast in quite a while.
Almost 5 years, I think.
Almost 5 years. Good grief.
Yeah, the last one we recorded was in January 2013 with Paul Frampton.
Oh, yeah.
Well, listen, Roseanne went on a 20-year hiatus, so we're pikers compared to her.
Yeah, and whatever happened to Gabriel and Daniel, who knows? But at this point, I guess the...
No one knows.
No. I mean, clearly not.
But it is April 14th, 2018, and mixandmojo.com still exists for reasons that, you know, aren't entirely clear. But the three of us have been talking about ways to justify that continued existence, and one of the ideas we kicked around was maybe experimenting with another one of these podcasts.
Yeah, and this is the first of its type, I think, in terms of concentrating on one game in defense of it, for that matter.
Yes, we had to pick a topic, so we picked Escape from Monkey Island. That's what we'll be talking about.
And that's
today.
Pretty typical of Mojo marketing, is that we disappear for 5 years and then we pick the least popular game on the site, and that is what we decide to cover. Games that nobody cares about.
We haven't covered Zack McCracken a lot, though, have we?
That's true.
It's not exactly the most popular thing.
That's true, but there's no way in hell I would actually sit down and try to play that.
I will not tolerate any shade heaped upon Zack McCracken. I'm just going to throw that out there.
All right.
Or Labyrinth, for that matter.
Labyrinth, I would do.
Have any of you played Labyrinth?
That's a classic.
I can confirm we have not ever done a podcast about Labyrinth.
Well, that's probably okay.
But we went with Escape because I think it's probably a richer vein. I feel like if we had picked Day of the Tentacle, it would just be an hour of us saying that it's a great game and then nothing interesting would have been expressed. I also think Escape is an interesting game in terms of context, because I feel like, and you guys can disagree with me if you feel differently, I feel like the release of that game kind of coincided with perhaps the height of the LucasArts fan scene. You know, it existed a few years leading up to that, more like the 97-ish area, but I feel like around Escape is when it really became this organized thing. And I remember Escape being covered and hyped in a way that's, you know, that games get hyped now, where, you know, every time a screenshot comes out, everyone was kind of pouring over it. And I remember there being like an actual community by that point. So I remember the lead up to Escape very clearly.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense. I mean, at that point, the internet was getting bigger and bigger, and the fan sites started being fairly common on GeoCities and stuff like that. So with the hype, I think that came from Curse, which had a fairly decent online following at that time. It kind of did make sense that the ball started rolling and the hype that started surrounding Escape kind of just came about at that point.
And in terms of where LucasArts was, it's an interesting snapshot in time as well, because in retrospect, it was really like the beginning of the end. But at the time, I remember the tone being a lot more optimistic, because we were coming out of this period where LucasArts was just making nothing but Phantom Menace tie-ins. In fact, I think this is an accurate statement. From 1998 through 2002, if you subtract Grim Fandango, Monkey Island 4, and maybe Infernal Machine, literally every other release was a Star Wars game.
Yeah, I think at the same time, a lot of people were looking at it as two separate entities in LucasArts, and I think that went for the developers too, because, I mean, they had separate games being produced, like the Full Throttle sequel, and Mike Stemley was working on a couple of games that got canceled. But I think there was a certain optimism within the company too, that they didn't really know where original titles were heading at that point.
They had lost so much of the talent by that point. Like, obviously, Ron and Dave were long gone, but Tim left at the beginning of 2000. Ackley and Ahern were gone. But it was also when Simon Jeffrey became president, so there was this talk about, like, how they were going to finally maybe go back to their roots and make more original games and for various reasons that didn't actually happen.
Yeah, Mojo had an interview with him, didn't he? E3 2001, where he said it would be 50% original, 50% Star Wars, but that never happened.
Well, if you look at what he actually put in production, it was accurate. But, you know, games ended up like being canceled and or being terrible or not selling well, because, I mean, they had Gladius, they had Wrath Unleashed, they had RTX Red Rock.
I think he made the mistake of thinking that he was in charge when really he had a board and Lucasfilm in general that was overseeing LucasArts at that point. And that seemed to be the case with a lot of the CEOs that followed them too.
Well, and also you can have the best intentions, and if you don't have the talent, like I think in the whole back half of the 90s, there was such a migration of talent because nobody wanted to texture map a stormtrooper, which is apparently what everyone was being forced to do between like 96 and 99. So by the time they decided to get their act together, there was like so few people left to make those kinds of games.
The problem was Star Wars was coming back, wasn't it? The special editions, and then by the time the prequel trilogy came out, they basically just had to make games based on those.
And in their defense, they actually did release a couple of good Star Wars games too, with the Jedi Knight series, and they were well received both critically and commercially. So for it being a relatively large company, if you look at the parent company, it kind of does make sense that they went the way they did, apparently with Wrath Unleashed and everything like that, not exactly setting the world on fire.
Yeah, I think they just went way overboard with all the Phantom Menace tie-ins. I think there was something like, I mean, my math could be wrong here, but I think it was 785 Podracer games at one
point. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they realized they had to course correct, I don't think there was any way to do it.
But maybe we should circle back to Escape from Monkey Island.
Okay, well, let's start. Do you agree? What do you guys say? There seems to be a consensus that it's the least of the five Monkey Island games. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and we did that little informal, you know, which games do you like or dislike a couple of months back, and Escape from Monkey Island ended up on bottom of all the LucasArts adventures in general.
You see, I don't agree with that.
No, I don't either.
I would say The Dig is a worse game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Zach McCracken, like we said before, good grief, it's not a great game.
Well, Zach McCracken was from a different time, too.
My problem with this is the art is really, the 3D art does not age very well.
Yeah, the engine is a good starting point because, well, obviously they reused the engine that was built from the ground up for Grim Fandango, and I don't know what the motivation was. It very possibly could have been a mandate for getting the game greenlit.
Yeah, and I think Mike Stemley has actually said that they were told that was the engine they were going to use.
So I think, I mean, we can definitely objectively criticize the artwork, but it should be pointed out that, like, when you're following up a game like Curse of Monkey Island, which had hand-drawn backgrounds, I mean, and then you have to follow it up with a game made with that engine, that, you know, a pre-rendered 3D engine circa, you know, the year 2000, you know, that's not a... You're behind the eight ball.
That was the problem of all games by that time, because by the mid-90s, you could finally do high-res 2D art, and it finally looked good. But then everybody jumped on the 3D bandwagon, which looked incredibly crude back then.
Yeah, but I still will say that, okay, yeah, if you look at the characters right now, obviously they're not looking particularly good. But at the time, at least they looked, I would say, about average, and... The backgrounds, maybe we can talk about the technical part of
well,
the backgrounds.
I think, I think the artist did an admirable job. It's just that when you think of Monkey Island, you don't think of admirable job. You think of like, you know, I mean, Curse of Monkey Island almost looked like a Disney movie. Like it was really kind of like a gold standard. I mean, apparently it even scared away Blizzard from releasing a Warcraft adventure game they'd been working on for 2 years. So it was such like a high watermark that I think they were kind of doomed to deliver something that was going to look inferior to that once they committed to that engine.
Right. And I mean, at the same time, too, if you look at some of the concept art, it is really all over the place in terms of style. And I mean, the style on some of them are completely different than what you see in the game. So you had a bunch of different artists working with their individual styles, and it doesn't seem like there was much of a cohesive decision-making about how they ended up rendering that art, and thusly you do get a game that is all over the place, not just in quality, but in style. So if you look at, for example, Lucre Island and compare it to Melee Island, you know, it looks like something from two different games, something that could be a piratey game, something that looks like it. I think a lot of people called it the Smurf Village. So, I mean, it's kind of bizarre.
I think it was Marek Braunstring of Adventure Gamers who made that point.
And a good point it was.
But I remember an interview with Bill Tiller, and I couldn't find it before we started recording. It wasn't a Mojo interview, but he actually talked a little bit about the fourth Monkey Island game. And if I remember correctly, you can't quote me on this, but I think this is true. He mentioned that he was actually lobbying to be on the art team for Escape from Monkey Island, but due to some kind of internal politics, or maybe he couldn't get out of his assignment, he couldn't get assigned to the game. And without like overtly, you know, dissing the artist, he did intimate that he thought the game could have looked better even given the technology it was made in.
At least it wasn't fully 3D, because that would have really killed the art style.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have been able to do that at the time. They wouldn't even have the budget for it, I'm sure. But I mean, the lead artist that they picked was actually an animator, not a background artist. So you got kind of into a strange conundrum as far as that goes.
And I guess to bolster that argument further, you could point out that Grim Fandango is pretty much, you know, it's a much more visually interesting game than Escape with the same engine. I mean, even a more primitive version of the engine. Although, it should be pointed out that Grim has a very, very unique art style that's kind of ingenious. I mean, the whole idea of, like, melding, you know, film noir and Mexican folklore and Casablanca was just, like, such a cool idea, and I also think it was an idea that just happened to work well with the technology of the time, both in terms of the architecture and the character design. I think it was Tim Schafer who said that, like, the character models in those days basically looked like papier-mâché skeletons, and that's exactly what they were trying to render. So I think there was this sort of, I'm not going to say coincidental, but I think there was this really nice marriage between art and technology with Grim Fandango, and then to have to follow that up and try to make a lush cartoonish world with the same engine. I think that was a tall order.
Another problem with that too was that Grim's budget was a lot higher than Escape from Monkey Island, which
true. Although I guess they had to build the engine from scratch too, though.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I mean, I've heard, you know, and don't quote me on this, but that Escape from Monkey Island had a budget that was under $1 million, that I've heard the number 700,000 have been thrown around, which is
wow,
not something you build a game on.
And it came out pretty much on schedule. We were talking about this before. I think it was announced in April of 2000, and it came out in November. So it was...
It came out on the schedule that was announced, but apparently that schedule had been cut down pretty well to be able to get it out before Thanksgiving so they could hit the Christmas shopping market. And I think even in the Secret History interviews, I think Stemley talks about that the last third of the game was thrown together really quickly, even the design of it.
I think... you know, we keep making, you know, we keep criticizing the art, but I do think, and I think you agree with me, the game looks good. It's not by any means a bad looking game, but it's like you're following up something that's way better right than pretty good.
No, and I mean, you know, you look at certain locations, say the exteriors of Meat Hook's place. I mean, it looks very, very good, but I think what a lot of people were criticizing it for was that it didn't actually look like the original location, in terms of that there used to be a bunch of mountains behind, or cliffs or whatever, behind his house, that now all of a sudden were gone.
So yeah, but that ventures into just, you know, I don't know if that's a reasonable complaint that they didn't.
I don't think it is, but I mean, it's like, yeah, who cares? But I think a lot of people are criticizing the graphics wholesale just because of details having been changed from the originals. And I agree, I don't really think that's something that is that big of a deal. But it kind of comes back to how I feel the game was unfairly judged, is that you start looking at some very superficial aspects of the game. And
yeah, and of course, nobody wanted to hear about direct control because you had three games that were point and click. Nobody wants change, especially not, you know, people who are into a niche genre. They tend to be even more protective. So I think that was a hard sell, too. I mean, look at how many people had trouble accepting Curse of Monkey Island just because it wasn't made by the same folks and the art style had changed. And then Escape is asking you to make an even bigger leap, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I think if people post on the forum, they tend to have, you know, A, very strong feelings, and B, they don't like change. That's just, it doesn't matter if it's a movie or if it's a game, but yeah.
You bring a good point about, you know, people complaining about how Melee Island looked and so forth, because it's like, it speaks to, like, the biggest irony of this game is the way it bends over backwards to try to pander to kind of the veteran Monkey Island fans, and that's the exact group that kind of rebelled against it, while I think I get the impression anyway that it's the people new to the series that embrace the game more. And yet the game is so hostile to newcomers in terms of, you know, assuming background information, and the puzzle design is particularly hard for being the last LucasArts adventure game.
Yeah, you know, part of the thing with how that worked out, and I have no idea how the design worked, but it almost feels like some of the fan pandering was thrown in, not last moment or anything like that necessarily, but that they had a original script that was very heavy on the pop culture criticism and commercialism and gentrification and all that stuff. And that, it, you know, that it took a look at it and said, well, we kind of need to make a Monkey Island game.
It's not a very piratey story, though. It's a story that could be set today, and I think that's my problem with it. It doesn't really feel like a Monkey Island game when you look at the story.
Yeah, it's kind of more of a Sam and Max game in that sense, I guess. But I mean, you know, they tried to course correct that a little bit.
It's a really fun idea, and I think they probably didn't. It was probably hard to foresee the consequence that it would have in terms of, you know, like Roger says, it feels a little bit less piratey, but, you know, it kind of goes with the art style criticism too, like the criticism that the pirate villages have these weird Smurf shaped rooftops and things look kind of sterile. I mean, the uncharitable way of looking at that is that it just looks funny, but I guess the other way you could look at it is that it shakes hands nicely with the whole idea of, you know, they look kind of like theme parks. They have that kind of facade pirate town look that kind arguably works nice with the story, where you've got these, you know, villainous entities coming and basically turning pirate locations into essentially theme parks. I mean, Jambalaya Island is straight up downtown Disney. I mean, it's not even disguised. It's, you know, there's a Planet Hollywood in there.
It's a part of the story that goes back to the first two games, where it was implied that the whole thing was a theme park, wasn't it?
Right. Oh yeah, that's always been, there's always been that kind of parallel from the beginning. So they I think they were start. I think the idea. I don't think they were off the mothership with the idea, but I think by kind of taking it as far as they did, they kind of maybe unintentionally ended up with a game that just didn't feel like this captivating piratey world. Because as much as Monkey Island always trafficked in, you know, meta humor and anachronisms and all these kind of this subtext, I think Escape basically pulls the subtext up into the text. And I think the result is still like a really interesting, funny game, but it kind of undid one of the main come-ons of the series, which is like, I want to get lost in this, you know, Buccaneer world.
Yeah, and I mean, it also comes back to, I think, the budget and the time constraints too, is that there's a possibility that if they had the chance to go back into a second or third pass or whatever over the script, they might have kind of evened out the pirate stuff and the more pop culture and commercialism criticism a little bit more than they ended up doing. I don't know. That's kind of hard to say.
I also think Escape really benefits now from being
a middle chapter than like the last chapter, because when back when it was the final Monkey Island game, it was a little bit, it left kind of a bad taste in your mouth, because it's like, this really isn't reflective of the atmosphere of the series. But now that it's the fourth out of five games, you can kind of see it as, oh, that was like an interesting little side trip. I find it a lot less offensive than I might have at the time of release.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, having replayed at least the part of it over the last week or so, the humor is good. It's a funny game, and it's a little bit easier now to enjoy that aspect of it, the humor that might be a little bit less, like, the style isn't the same as the last three games, but now it's a little bit easier to enjoy it, because you do have that, like you said, the next game in the series that kind of went back to the roots a little bit more. So it's, you know, kind of interesting to have sort of an outlier in the series now, instead of having the final chapter of it being what it was.
Well, speaking of the humor, I agree it's a very funny game, because I replayed it recently as well to prepare for this. I think the writing is something that's gotten indicted as well. I will say, I think it's probably the most inconsistent. I think it's got the highest highs and the lowest lows as far as, like, the humor. Like, they're the funniest parts of Escape from Monkey Island are some of the funniest parts in the whole series, but the worst parts are just, like, really bad.
Yeah, it's groan-worthy at times, but, I mean, I think they have admitted after the fact that the script was way too big. I think it was 10,000 lines of dialogue or something like that, and there's just going to be so much packed in that you're not editing out, you know, more of the groan-worthy lines.
You definitely can tell that there's a lot more dialogue in this. And I think you're right about the 10,000 lines. And I think that makes it, I think it's got more recorded dialogue than any LucasArts adventure game. I think Grim Fandango even has 8,000. And I guess Curse may be a little bit less than that. So I'm pretty sure that's an accurate statistic, that it's actually got the most recorded dialogue of any LucasArts adventure game. I will say this, though. I like the fact that there's a ton of dialogue, but I think the problem is that when there's too much, It's when the essential dialogue is overridden.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there should be any limit to dialogue if it's all just kind of playing around with dialogue trees and finding all these extra jokes. But there's just a little bit of a sense that it is kind of overwritten at times. And then I think A Vampire Story came around and took that flaw and kind of magnified it. But you could see it with Escape for sure. It's a little bit less tight. But it's also a really funny game.
Yeah, when it works, it works. It works really well.
And the acting is so good, too. You talked about how the lead artist is an animator. I mean, the animation's great.
Well, the animation is fantastic, yeah.
Especially for the time. And I think the voice acting's the best of all the adventure games, because LucasArts, you know, they maybe regressed in some ways, but I think on the audio side, they always got better. And I mean, the voice acting is astonishingly good in this game.
What they did on the technical level, too, was that it used to be that you had to listen to a line, then you had the next line, yada, yada, with, you had a dialogue going, but here you actually had the chance to overlap the dialogue lines, which made it a little more natural.
Yeah, the editing feels like they had more control over the timing. And so the good jokes in the game really come off really well because of that.
You had some pretty big names in here, too. I mean, not huge names compared to what you do or what you see today, but I mean, Edie McClurg and stuff like that being in the game, some pretty big names.
Also, Maria Bamford, I think her name is, who nobody knew at the time, but she's a stand-up comic. She played Brittany the bank teller. She was in that recently canceled Netflix show, I think it was Lady Dynamite, and she was also in Arrested Development season 4. She and Tobias's character.
Yeah, she was great in the show.
We're together.
Her Netflix show was great too, but it definitely was bizarre. So yeah, I mean, yeah, voice acting was great. I mean, it's hard to say anything about that. The music too, I think, was maybe a little bit all over the map in style. I mean, they had five composers, I think, in there, but the main themes and quite a few of the individual cues, I think, are absolutely top-notch.
I think it's an excellent soundtrack. Like, the only criticism I think you could possibly levy at it is that maybe it's slightly less than Curse of Monkey Island. I think most of Escape's flaws comes down to, like, I think that's the worst you could say, is that it's just not as good as Curse, but, I mean, it's a fantastic
soundtrack.
Too bad about the audio compression, I guess, because it sounds probably sounds a little bit worse than it could have if they had gone with three CDs or something like that instead of the two CDs that it was originally released on.
There was still a mandate at that time to fit it all on two CDs. The PlayStation 2 version was a little bit more... There was more breathing room in that regard, I think.
Yeah, the PlayStation 2 version audio-wise or soundtrack-wise was kind of bizarre in terms of... I mean, the iMuse logo was on the disc, but I can't remember hearing that in the game at all.
They pretty much stopped using that once it went digital.
I don't think they were able to pull off iMuse on PS2. And also, you were talking about the overlapping lines. They couldn't do that either because it was all just read from a disc. They didn't have any hard drive space on the PS2, so... They actually had to ruin some of the gags in the game because they could only play one line at a time.
The PS2 had, 60 megabytes memory, so you had to load up every asset of every scene into that space before you started the scene, so they tried to stream as much as possible from the disc.
Yeah, that's why you got the loading times that were infuriating.
Yeah, I think the PC version is definitely the superior one. The only thing the PS2 version really has going for it is like the weird extras that it has, and obviously the controls are more suited to a gamepad, but it's not like the keyboard controls are, you know, unworkable or something.
As far as the iMuse goes, the one thing that I really need to point out with that one, that it's probably my favorite use of iMuse in any of the games, is the Jambalaya map, where it goes from major to minor key when you go from the left to the right toward nothing at all. I think that part is just awesome.
That's a very cool little flourish there, but for me it's still Woodtick and Monkey Island 2 and the Good Soup Hotel and Curse of Island.
Yeah, as far as the MIDI stuff goes, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Curse isn't MIDI, is it?
It's the third one where they went digital.
Yeah, but you said Woodtick, right?
Woodtick is MIDI.
Yeah, Woodtick is MIDI. So we talked a little bit about the game maybe having a rushed schedule, but I will say it's a very well designed game.
Yeah.
I think some of those puzzles are just absolutely obnoxious, but I mean, in general, it's a very, I mean, it's definitely up to the LucasArts standard, I would say. And I would reiterate that it's really punishing. And what's weird is that you could tell they acknowledged this because they shipped the game with a walkthrough, I think,
yes.
Which I think speaks volumes.
Yeah, some of the puzzles are definitely a little bit out there, but when they hit home, they really do hit home. So it's kind of like the dialogue, I guess, in that sense. But you have like the Mist of Time or whatever. I think that one's brilliant.
The marsh is fantastic. The diving trophy one is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, but so was the spinning contest. You know,
right.
It reminds me of that one a lot. Yeah, there were some fantastic puzzles. Puzzles I absolutely hated would include the whichever one you where you have to spin the dials that somehow map to a certain range of the alphabet in order to get the directions. That was just unacceptable.
Isn't that the one where you have to have like a sewer lid or something like that, and you have to get hints from the sewer lid?
Oh yeah, that was a different one. That was when you had to get the skin.
Well, that's a different one.
That was just ridiculous. And I also objected to the boulder puzzle.
Well, that one I liked. I thought that one was good because, I mean, that one you could follow pretty easily. There were a lot of hints when the boulders were rolling.
I'm biased because I'm terrible about puzzles like that. I consider that a missed type puzzle. And usually LucasArts was able to avoid that, but every once in a while, like Fate of Atlantis had a gear puzzle or two. The Dig had that puzzle where you had to reassemble the alien turtle skeleton, and then that puzzle where you had to navigate the crane. I'm terrible at stuff like that.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, that's why I'm surprised I like the boulder puzzle. But that one, you know, you had the hints by following the branches or whatever. So I don't know. Maybe it just worked for me.
It's interesting because in general, if you look at the LucasArts adventure game, there was a tendency for the puzzle design to get a little more forgiving. But I mean, it's not a perfect graph because, I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, Loom is much easier than a lot of other games that came after it. And I think, I think Sam and Max is harder than Day of the Tentacle. But there was kind of a general arc toward, you know, more reasonable puzzle design. But I think Escape kind of backtracked on that.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, if you look at Sam and Max, too, the puzzles in that game were definitely not as intuitive as LucasArts games were at that time. So it could just be down to Stemley and Clark as puzzle designers that that just is how their brains work, I guess.
Also, I think there's something about the Monkey Island name that makes the designers feel like they have to be, I'm not going to say regressive, but they have to be aimed a little bit more at the hardcore audience. And that goes back, and that is reflected in the interface too, because if you look at Curse, which reused the Full Throttle interface, it used the same interface, but it had to bring back inventory combination and the sentence line after Tim Schafer made like a very conscious choice to streamline that. Mm-hmm. I guess there was this sense that, you know, Monkey Island has trickier puzzles. We need inventory combination. And then you see it again with Escape. They reused the Grim engine, but one of the main alterations was they redesigned the inventory to accommodate puzzle combinations, and the sentence line came back. And then you look again at Telltale, one of like, removing inventory combination was like this, you know, it was like a precept or something. It was like a design principle from the very beginning, but they, as a one-time thing, they brought it back for a Monkey Island game. I think, I just think that's a really interesting trend. The way Monkey Island makes them kind of, it just makes them, the games have got to be harder somehow.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, if they were to make Monkey Island 6 or whatever today, I'm sure they would do the same thing, but I don't know. I mean, if they cut out the puzzle or the inventory combination, I don't think that many people at this point would miss it. It was from another time.
Yeah, I agree. And also, like, a lot of the things that bothered people about Monkey Island, you know, the 3D and the controls and all, that seems so much more... those issues seem so much more vital at the time, but when you look back on it all as a series, it really just seems like so much less of a deal than when we were 13, mm-hmm. or I was 13 at the time. I'm not going to date you guys, but maybe y'all are older.
I was 13 at the first game, so yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
That aside, should we talk about the last part of the game, the one part from that happens on Monkey Island?
I have to say, there's puzzles in this game that I will absolutely... you know, rant and rave about, but I never did get on board the monkey combat hate. I mean, I understand the main criticism, which is that it's basically they took the mechanic of sword fighting, of insult sword fighting, and made it not funny. But I don't know. When I was playing through it the other week,
tedious is the word you're looking for.
Yeah, tedious.
I agree. It's tedious, but I mean, insult sword fighting was tedious too. I mean, I was kind of enjoying figuring out the moves, and I also think it's well paced because I feel like by the time you would really get annoyed by it, it's over. I mean, you only have to defeat about three or four monkeys, and it's done.
That's true, but I think part of it too is not necessarily that it was in the game at that point, but that it was the last puzzle of the game, and it was kind of made a big deal out of it that this is the biggest thing that has happened in the Monkey Island series with the, you know, Mortal Kombat kind of animations and typeface on the screen and everything like that. It's just that it was made into such a large part of the game. I think, to me at least, that was a bigger deal than the actual puzzles themselves, because, yeah, they're not hard, but I don't know.
I saw the grandiosity as just a joke rather than like an, you know.
Yeah, but it didn't really work, I think. It wasn't the right time to have like a grandiose joke like that, I think, is my personal opinion.
I still say the Dead Eye Dave joke is puzzle is worse. I stand by that.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. Herman Tooth Rot.
Yeah. That's another one that I kind of think gets overblown. Of course, I'm the one who wrote that like ridiculous like rationale for it when we did
I remember that one. But no, I agree with you. I didn't think that was a big deal. And people, you see, most of the people who are complaining about it, their main point was the America's Cup, saying that, well, how could he have washed up in Australia or whatever? But I mean, the America's Cup is in Australia, not in the U.S. So,
well, I think there's a misconception that like people interpret that he's saying he washed up on Monkey Island. Well, I didn't even pay attention to that part of the game this time, so I don't think I'm even aware enough anymore to defend it. But I remember
being able to reason it out and argue that like it wasn't actually like a continuity error. But I will also say that I think you could object to that. I think there might be an issue with that part of the game that has nothing to do with whether or not it is a retcon.
Oh, yeah.
I think the biggest issue is the Monkey Island series really the sandbox to be throwing these Lost style revelations that, you know, recontextualize everything that came before. It kind of felt out of place. But I mean, if you're going to complain about that, you got to complain that Tales of Monkey Island did it with the voodoo lady, and I don't do that, so I mean, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a big deal. I actually kind of liked it as far as just dumb twist went, like
right,
kind of a
right.
soap opera twist. I thought it was kind of funny.
And Wally Wingert, who's the voice of Herman Toothrot, is so good.
Oh,
too.
He's fantastic.
Wasn't he a Jay Leno announcer for some period of time?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, what else was contra? I mean, we kind of keep talking about all the polarizing stuff about the game. Oh, well, we do have to talk about the relationship between Guybrush and Elaine was a little bit different this time out.
Yeah, but I mean, that's kind of, they had the follow-up curse on that one. I mean, curse was really the one that, I wouldn't say they messed it up, but they took a different angle to it than what it was in the two first games, which is what it is. I never had that big of an issue with it.
Yeah, but Escape from Monkey Island turns them into like an American sitcom married couple. I think it was Synthetic Gerbil, one of the Mojo readers, who said it reminded him of the Ray Romano dynamic with his wife on Everybody Loves Raymond.
All right, fair enough. I don't know. I didn't have a problem with it. I mean, yeah, it might have been a little bit of the sitcom feel to it, but it's kind of just part of the lighter humor, I guess. And it wasn't that much light humor in the game, seeing that it was pretty in your face as far as gentrification and whatever goes. So I don't know. It kind of just played off pretty well for me, at least.
I wonder if, what did you think about Elaine's voice actor? Because LucasArts reverted to the Curse of Monkey Island voice actress for the remasters, and then, you know, for Tales.
Why did they change her in the first place?
That's a good question.
I think Sean Clark, well, one of them, maybe him and Stem Lee, thought that the voice actress in Curse sounded too whiny. But I mean, as far as that goes, I didn't love her voice in Curse, but she had about 10 lines, I think, so it's kind of hard to judge.
Well, like, I just feel like half the humor in the relationship and Escape is just about, like, emasculating Guybrush, which, you know, Guybrush has always been, like, a goofball, so I get that part, but I feel like they kind of made Elaine look a little bit worse because they just made her, you know, a little bit more of a nag, I think, which I think kind of was unflattering to her character.
Yeah, I didn't think that character worked too well in either Curse or Escape, but I think they kind of made up for it in Tales.
With her character, was that she was the hero type, and Guybrush was not. Yeah, that was how they built her up in the first two games, and then she just became the damsel in distress in the third game.
Yeah, they've always made her like the dominant character in that relationship. That goes back from the beginning, but I feel like there's so much humor in Escape that's just like at Guybrush's expense. Like, I feel like they turned that dial way up in the fourth game.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, which is too bad because there were certainly sides of her that I think worked pretty well. The political debates and stuff like that I thought were, you know, pretty well implemented. So as far as the character goes, again, like, which has been an issue with a lot of that game, is that it was kind of all over the map, I guess.
What I like about Guybrush, and I guess this is true of like the whole series, is that like depending on the needs of the story, he's either like the biggest idiot in the world or like Einstein.
I think I agree with that. And I think, you know, what he did with the two first games was that he's really not a likable character. He's somebody who just comes in and bumbles around to achieve whatever makes him happy. He doesn't really care about anybody else in that sense. And I think that was Dave Grossman that has talked a lot about that. And I'm guessing maybe that was something he added to the character. I don't know.
I think there's another element of Escape that maybe turned people off. And I think it kind of relates to what we're talking about the nature of the story, is it feels like they kept shrinking the world of the game at this point in the series. Like, if you look at the maps... if you look at the map in Monkey Island 2, where they show Scab and Scab Island and Fat Island and Booty Island. I forget. I think they had some name for that area in that game. And then you look at Curse, which opens with a map. There's an image of a map in Curse, and it, like, there's an attempt to like retroactively show where those islands are located in the context of the rest of the islands in the series. And then in Escape, they do it again, only like none of those maps seem to relate to each other in any way. Right. So I think that was a turnoff too, because it kind of made it's part of like the game feeling a little bit less piratey. It feels like more of a contained game in that way. And you could tell that Tales of Monkey Island was a reaction to that, because they just completely went into a totally uncharted area. And I think they were able to bring back a little bit of that, going in uncharted waters type of deal. Whereas Escape feels so much more domesticated, you know, which is, you know, part of the storyline. They were returning home. They're running the island. They're governors. But I think that might have been a sticking point too. And what's funny is that I feel like by the end of this, of Escape from Monkey Island, the game like is addressing that, because it seems to deliberately set up an ending where the characters are like, yeah, we don't want to be here anymore. We're now going to go wherever we want.
Yeah, no, exactly. And yeah, it's interesting that you pointed to Tales, because yeah, I do think they wanted to make something that was a lot vaster, seeing that you could travel to all those tiny islands that were way on the outskirts of the map.
Well, speaking of the Escape from Monkey Island ending, it has this gargantuan like 6-minute or whatever it is cutscene. Do you think that was a reaction to the ending of Curse? Because like the one complaint that everyone has about Curse is that it's a little bit of a rushed ending cinematic.
I think they said it wasn't, but I kind of do think it was. Because, I mean, that was almost the case with Monkey Island 2. The ending was short. Same with, I mean, all the, you know, the three first games had short endings. And I think it worked in the first two games, but in the third one, it didn't. And that might have been just because it was more of a cinematic looking game that kind of stood out a little bit more, I guess. But yeah, to me, it seems like that was a direct reaction in Escape to make it huge like they did. That's my opinion, at least.
Well, and also for Curse, they had designed a longer ending, but they just had to cut it out. So there was an intention, right, at least.
Yeah, no, exactly. And as far as the ending in Escape, score that they have through that ending is really, really good. And that was obviously something that went up online for download for a while from the composer, and LucasArts kindly asked him to take it down, I guess.
Yeah, it was the only cutscene tune from Escape from Monkey Island that ended up in circulation, because I think it was Clint Bajakian who put it out, and then I guess he was stopped, which is too bad, because maybe we would have gotten the rest of the cutscene music as well.
Yeah, but for now at least, it doesn't seem like that is going to surface anytime soon.
Another reason I wanted to do the podcast about Escape rather than another game is that, ironically, despite being the most recent of the 14 adventure games that LucasArts put out, it's the only one you can't legally buy right now. We're in a really privileged time where you can actually legally buy all the other games. It seemed like that was never going to happen, but now you can buy them all on GOG and Steam, and right. Escape's the only one you can't purchase, so it'll be nice to see it show up at some point.
Well, does it actually run on newer Windows machines at all?
I was able to get it to run on a Windows 10 machine. I mean, it crashed a couple of times, but I'm pretty sure it did in 2000 as well. So,
yeah, I ran it on, because I'm running a Mac, I ran it on the Residual, and it wasn't exactly stable. I mean, music went in and out, and you had crashes and everything like that. And I don't know, I'm just sort of kind of wondering that, I mean, with the previous games, they put them up on GOG and Steam using ScumVM. With Escape, they would obviously use Residual, and it's not particularly stable. So I'm wondering if that's part of it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe because they would actually have to do some work to get it to run, that disqualifies it. Whereas with the other games, they could just outsource to other people's work and just bundle it with ScumVM.
Yeah, nobody knows.
Did you all buy the game when it came out? I remember pre-ordering it. I got I have the big box version of Escape from Monkey Island. You know, Lady Settle Down.
Yeah, I bought the big box version.
Yeah, I did too. I like
that. With the golden signatures of Sean Clark and Mike Stimley?
Yeah.
Nope, not available here. LucasArts never sent to Europe.
True, they didn't. Yeah, I got that, but yeah, I don't have the box anymore. I think I sold it off with pretty much all big box games. How about you? Do you still have it?
I do still have it. It came with a magnet set, yeah. and the signatures. Those were the pre-order bonuses. And I remember that when I got the game, first of all, I really enjoyed the game when I got it. I did like the game. I shared a lot of the problems that other people had, but I did really enjoy the game overall. But I remember not being able to play it originally because it turned out my computer or the computer at my family's house couldn't actually run it. So I actually started playing the game at like other friends' houses until we had upgraded. I remember that distinctly. Can I install this game?
I remember
game?
The demo was really big.
Yeah.
And it was like 110 megabytes and it took 5.5 hours to download.
And yeah. The demo also lets you explore a location that was blocked off in the game, which is the docks of Melee Island.
Oh.
I guess they cut it off because there's not actually anything you could do there, or at least there wasn't in the demo.
Yeah,
you see the background once when, after that first cutscene where Elaine and Guybrush walk off the boat, it turns into a in-engine cutscene, and you actually see them in that background, but you're not able to walk there.
It kind of makes sense that they cut it out, because, I mean, it would just kind of be there as a dead end. There's nothing there.
Yeah. I guess there's enough red herrings in any adventure game.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, when it was released, I liked it, too, and I remember most people didn't. People were pretty angry about it. So if you kind of said that you liked it, you know, you were called apologists and everything like that. It was kind of interesting to see how much people claimed to hate it, at least at the time.
I think it's a really good game. I mean, it was definitely better than... It was also at a point where, like, it's not like there were that many adventure games coming out at the time.
Right.
It was kind of the end of the AAA adventure game. They always would continue to exist. But, like, this was definitely... I mean, post-Grim Fandango, it was kind of the death of the... the death of adventure games that were going to attempt to compete with other genres in terms of like production values.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. The Longest Journey was released at the same time, and people loved that game for whatever reason.
That game is extremely old school, especially the puzzle design, and it's all 2D as well.
There's a lot to like about The Longest Journey, but it is a dull game, and I mean,
yeah, no, I mean this.
It does have it does have a lot of atmosphere, though.
Yeah.
Really creates a great world, which Escape doesn't.
But I think Escape is still really above average. It's an above average. What I always say is, I think it's
The Metacritic for Escape is at 86. Right.
Yeah,
now.
It was.
And Curse is at 89. Yeah, so
it wasn't lambasted when it came out, except from the hardcores.
Oh yeah, no, it got good reviews. It's basically just, yeah, the hardcores, which, when you think about it, how many people were that? Probably not that many.
I think it's objectively just like a really strong adventure game. It's living up to its pedigree that sometimes it struggles with a little bit. But, I mean, I enjoyed it when I replayed it quite a bit. And I contend it's by no means at the bottom of the barrel. I mean, none of the LucasArts adventure games are bad. So we're talking relative terms here. When we say something was disappointing or controversial, but...
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's highly underrated. I mean, yeah, it has its issues, but I think people are talking up the issues a lot more than they need to. The positive sides of it, I mean, it's overall a good game. I like it.
We were talking about Monkey Combat. One thing I'll say about this game is I think it's the only Monkey Island game that forces you to write stuff down. Like, regularly.
Yeah, unless it was the PlayStation 2 version when they had the little map that you could bring up, I guess.
Oh, yeah, the Monkey Combat map. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a huge oversight that they didn't think to include some sort of UI to track your moves for that. I'd like to think if they'd had, like, another month or two of development, they would have, you know, thought to put that in.
Oh, they probably did. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't have put it in the PlayStation 2 version. I mean, they must have started development on that pretty quickly after. I mean, I think it was released, about half a year or something after the PC version?
Something like that. Yeah, you actually interviewed the producer of the PS2 version, like, at the time, so you should be the expert on all that.
Yeah, I did. I think I had, like, 7 questions for about what I could even think. I mean, it's hard to interview somebody about a game that you've never seen before. So I kind of had to just come up with some questions based on screenshots.
It is a unique port. I don't think that it's... I mean, I think the PC version is the way to go by far, but, like, it does have... I think the cutscenes, while they're really crunched down in the PC version, or like DVD quality, in the PS2 version, and we're talking about the, I think the voice samples are a lot better quality, and it's got like an extra mini game for some reason.
Yeah,
was it Monkey Invaders?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the cutscenes that were pre-rendered in a couple of them, not the cutscenes, but at least some of the backgrounds that were pre-rendered are part of the foreground, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's some weird oddities like that. I think I had also, and I, you know, don't quote me on this, but I think there was like, it was found that like 1 or 2 lines of dialogue were exclusive to the PS. It's like they had some extra dialogue in the PS2 version.
Yeah.
And a couple of random dialogue trees.
Which, I mean, yeah, is what it is. I don't think that game needed more dialogue, so... It is what it is, I guess.
Oh, and talking about puzzles that stand out, we talked about the Mist of Time Marsh. I was also a fan of the parrot puzzle. I thought that was a really clever one.
Oh, yeah, the parrot puzzle. That was good. And you had the hand puppets. I thought that one was pretty good, too.
Yeah, that was an excellent puzzle. I love the whole... I think Nick Jameson plays Hellbeard. The Unrepentant. That's another great line. So this was the last LucasArts adventure game, but it wasn't the last one they attempted. In other words, it wasn't designed as the last LucasArts adventure game.
Right, and I mean, after that they had, one of the Full Throttle games, I guess, would have been at the same time, right about, when they started writing it, at least.
I guess Full Throttle would have ended up being a hybrid game, but Freelance Police was certainly going to be a point-and-click game. That would have been interesting to see what a full 3D point-and-click game would have looked like coming out of LucasArts. You know, obviously we have a very limited view of it, but it seemed like it would have worked just fine. I mean, obviously the Telltale games, the early Telltale games worked that way.
Yeah, and I mean, it was pretty close to done, which is still kind of bizarre that it ended up, you know, being what it was, but apparently they were having some consultant firm come in and they said adventure games were dead, which was kind of strange, I guess. But
I remember very vividly, I think it was at the end of 2003, there was some sort of online... Well, it was like a poll or a...
It was a Survey Monkey kind of
that's
thing.
That's right. It was a survey and it acts very, very just... portentous questions about like how do you feel about adventure games and digital distribution.
Yeah, I mean it was leading questions all over the map.
Whenever there's a web survey involved, that's always a good sign that something is about to die.
Oh yeah. I wonder how much, I mean, you can kinda imagine that this consultant firm too got paid quite a lot of money to actually go in and do that, and I think pretty much all they would have done was pull a couple of numbers and put out that Survey Monkey survey thing. I just don't see how. I mean, it was like Mike Stemley said, it's what happened. Did the whole country of Germany all of a sudden just fall off the map or something like that? I mean, it didn't seem like a particularly well thought out survey to me, at least.
Well, it was at that point they were like without a president, and there was this they were in this transitional phase where they were basically being run, it seems like, by Lucasfilm executives who really didn't have any sort of interest or connection to games, then they just sort of, it was like a let's cut our losses type of decision.
It was some pretty dark times there. Exactly what happened, I still don't, I mean, what part I'm more curious about is the full throttle game, the one that Sean Clark was heading, what happened to that one? That one seems to kind of just, you don't hear that much folklore or urban legend about that one. That one has some interesting stories, though, about one of the business people at LucasArts, Randy Breen. And some people have probably seen the Scumbar screenshot that off screen you have Randy Sucks written. And that was a reference to Randy Breen, who apparently from what we have been told, kind of fancied himself to be a creative as well as a businessman. And part of his objections with Full Throttle, apparently, the sequel, was that they wanted to put the cavefish in it, and he could not understand why they would want to put fish into a game about motorcycles. So that kind of just gives a good idea about where LucasArts was at that point as far as creative versus business decisions went.
And also, like, so many of the people, by the time Escape from Monkey Island went into production, there was really no adventure game project leaders left except for Stemley, Clark, and I guess Hal Barwood. But, you know, obviously Hal Barwood wasn't making adventure games anymore.
He made RTX, I mean, I guess, yeah.
I think even if Sam & Max 2 had come out, I don't think there was really a future. I mean, Stemley was the only guy left, really, qualified to head up an adventure game.
I think Sean Clark was working on that game, though, after Full Throttle folded. Sean Clark, I think, went on that team.
Right, they reassigned him, mm-hmm. Which makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, what else could he do? I mean, and after Sam & Max, I guess, Stemley wrote the dialogue for Jedi Outcast or something like that.
Yeah, the end of LucasArts gets very hazy to me. Mm. I mean, it really didn't close till 2012, but I mean, it was essentially over as like an in-house developer around that time.
And the goal for a while, apparently, had been to basically become a clearinghouse, and I guess that's what they turned
Mission
into.
Mission accomplished.
Oh, yeah, very well.
Is there anything else? Roger, you've been pretty quiet. What do you think about Escape from Monkey Island, sir?
The reason why I've been a bit quiet is because I played a game back in 2001, and I haven't really played it since then.
Oh, you haven't played it since 2001? That's awesome.
No, I played it when it came out using a walkthrough because I thought the puzzles were extremely tedious, and then I never touched it again after I completed it.
Nice.
So that's my story with the game.
I will say, we talked about how it was kind of like an atmosphere vacuum, but I don't think that's exclusively the case. Again, it's all relative to, like, you know, one of the best games ever made when we say these things. There were definitely moments in Escape that were really, I thought, kind of captivating. I like that moment where you're talking to Carla and Otis while the Michael Land accordion music is playing. I really enjoyed the moment on the beach where you're talking to Jumbo Lafitte. Like, there are definitely moments in the game where you could see, like, yes, this is, I wish the whole game was like this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it had its ups and downs, but, I mean, in the end, I thought it was an enjoyable game, and I thought it was an enjoyable Monkey Island game, too, which is, you know, the criticism that seems to be thrown against it a lot of times is that, yeah, it's a fine game, but it's not a good Monkey Island game. I still think it's definitely a solid Monkey Island game.
Yeah, that always sounds kind of dismissive and pissy when they say that. So yeah, Escape from Monkey Island, underrated.
Definitely.
If you guys enjoyed this and you want to see more, please let us know, because we're only going to do this if there's any kind of sense that people want it. We did this just sort of speculatively, but, you know, we could do more if you have anything specific you'd like us to talk about. And if not, you know, you're looking at another eight-year hiatus, and Gabez's death will have been in vain. So it's really up to you.
And if you want to see more of Mojo, other than going to mixandmojo.com, obviously, for the site, we are on Twitter. Our handle is mixandmojo. And if you would like to support us, then you can go to our Patreon account, patreon.com/mixandmojo. We're on iTunes, we're on Google Play, and we are on Stitcher? Is that what it's called? Stitcher, whatever. And if you want to follow us there, that's great. You can follow the podcast. And if you can give us a 5-star rating, we feel like we deserve it. So, you know, consider it.
And you forgot the YouTube account.
I have no... YouTube.com/HouseOfMojo? Something like that. Whatever. Nobody uses YouTube.
And also, I'm just gonna throw it out there that we are going to try to bring back the games database at some point and restore a lot of old content, a lot of old articles that we never got around to, you know, sliding back in there. We do have plans.
We have
for the future of Mojo.
We have so many plans, and
they're none of them are gonna happen. Don't get me wrong, but we have plans
for the last 5 years, but. You know, something might happen.